Good afternoon. It's Tuesday, March the 15th, and it's 5 p.m. London time. Next week, my guest is in New Zealand, so we'll be going live at a very different time of day. But this week, my guest is Ollie Barrett, who is also today in London. And Ollie and I met, we were just reminiscing a bit. We met a little bit before the pandemic in the days before all of that. And, there have been challenges to all of us, but Ollie is well known as the most connected man in Britain and is often talking to even more people than I talk to. And I love the way you actually pivoted to how can I help people, what can I do, what can I share. So I'm sure you've got lots of stories to tell us, but welcome to What Comes Next Live, and tell us a bit about yourself and let's see what you want to talk about.
Thank you, Tom, and kudos to you for doing this podcast. The reason we met is I'd seen so much of what you share literally on a daily basis, and so I was very much looking forward to meeting. And then we had this hiatus that you've hinted at for a couple of years, but I'm a huge admirer of how you, without fail, even if it's later in the afternoon, to say it's been a chill day today, you managed to put something out into the world. I honestly don't know how you do it. There must be days when you think, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, and I remember from meeting you in person that you're one for very much a turn of the tables on someone like being a professional coach by asking questions, which is perfectly cool. The short answer is, which I've given before, is because a lot of people aspire to write daily or post daily. Mm. First of all, that's not for everybody. But they say there is this concept of it takes 30 days to begin to form a habit. So then you just keep at it. And after about 100 days, people said to me, so how do you come up with things to write about? How do you do it? What's your method, et cetera? And my simplified version was, I'm a writer, I write.
Yeah.
And then about a year later, a French gentleman called Rémi Guillot was messaging me off Twitter going, I'm thinking about writing, you know, and I kind of encouraged them. And his thing was longer form, but less often. And he wrote a thing about the reasons why people write. And one of them just said, I was about writing to develop your thoughts. So Hemingway talked about sitting down at the typewriter and bleeding. And the other people talk about the tyranny of the blank page. But I sit down and I might have the germ of a thought in my mind. And then as I start writing it, something will happen. And yes. sometimes my thoughts will develop as I write them. And yeah. So sometimes it can be simply an observation around, you know, an awareness piece the other day, like I'm just going to take a chill date and that's the end of the story today. And other times I'll write something much more involved. But it's part of who I am now. I just take roughly an hour a day in writing.
Yeah, I think it's so powerful. And I was thinking about it today. One of the things I love doing is hosting, broadcasting, comparing, if you like, events. And I hosted a 2-day event last week on a whole range of business topics. And today, you know, back in the old days, you know, blogging was much more common in my view, people actually taking the time to reflect on something they'd been through. And this entrepreneur, Kim, who has this wonderful company, Auris Tech, which does real time, sort of speech translation, if you like, for children to help their reading. And she just took the time to do a really thoughtful reflection on everything she'd taken from the conference, what she'd learned. And I thought, number one, that's an act of generosity. And number two, I bet that's also been very clarifying for her own thoughts. Mm-hmm. Just take that time. So, I'm very interested in that. And as a sort of budding facilitator, I'm always very grateful, because when you're up there on the stage, you don't always have the time afterwards to do that reflecting. If it's helpful, Tom, I got started after college. I went and worked at Disney World out in the States. So I literally have a Mickey Mouse degree. I went off to university briefly, Edinburgh, Leeds, dropped out twice, went and became, for British listeners, a butlin redcoat. And that just gave me a sense of comfort with getting people to do things a bit differently. And yes, that was playing a silly game or doing a silly competition. Transplant that to the business world. It meant I wasn't afraid to stir things up and try to challenge the status quo. So what ended up happening was I started my first company way back when at uni. It was an alternative careers fair, 150 of us organizing events in 9 cities. And it gave me that entrepreneurial spark that led me to want to make a career out of helping to start things. So string one to the bow has always been, how can I team up with co-founders to start things, whether that's campaigns. I started Tenor, where we've given out over 500,000 10-quid notes to kids in an entrepreneurship challenge. Startup Britain with Number 10, a big national campaign with the backing of the Prime Minister, and also lots of businesses as well, some successful, some not. I suppose the core theme, though, is team up with interesting people, try to join a few dots, try to have fun along the way, and yeah, don't be afraid to dust yourself off and give it another go.
And that's, so over the last number, so you've as you've just reflected, and thank you for the background for the listening audience, you started up a bunch of things very successfully, and in more recent years it has been much more the focus on things like comparing, hosting, etc. That clearly got shut down radically, literally 2 years ago today, pretty much. In the UK, at least, was when things closed down. What went through your mind? And then once things had gone through your mind, what crystallized about starting things and joining the few dots and teaming with interesting people?
Well, other than the concern around what was emerging from Wuhan and China, when the fact emerged that that meant no more events, to be brutally honest, Tom, my initial reaction was one of relief. I'd been doing way too many of them for my own health, physically and mentally. I was fairly shattered, and I thought, to be perfectly honest, if it gives me a few months off, then that's a good thing. And being normally very glass half full, I said to my wife, look, this could be nothing until September, so we might brace ourselves. Little did we know, of course, it would be 2 years. And as I was thinking through it, well, first of all, I thought, well, how can I be useful? Because, you know, I'm a shareholder in quite a few businesses, including a theatre business, immediately thrown into turmoil. So first of all, how can I be useful? So whether that was in practical terms, how can I help you to people around me, whether it was literally hosting get togethers online where people could share their, you know, whatever was on their mind and not feel guilty or afraid to do that. And then practically on a work front, my life was changed by a coach, actually, brilliant guy, Eric Partica. And I had a session with him and I said, well, I don't think I'll be doing any paid work for the year. As you know, Eric, I'd love to ladder up one day to broadcast, television, radio. And I think I'll be doing a lot of video calls. I can already tell that. And it was Eric that helped me join the dots. And he, as you're a brilliant listener, he listened and he said, do the video calls give you a chance to practice that broadcasting? And I thought, I think they do. And as if by magic, a day later, the phone was ringing saying, Ollie, will you conduct a series of interviews from your living room? And one call led to another. And to cut a very long story short, I ended up spending 2 years on auto cues with earpieces, fielding questions from live and studio and virtual audiences, and doing something that I'd never have conceived I'd do 2 years ago, but hopefully being helpful along the way.
And that's helped you, as you said, ladder up. Has that helped you move towards what might be next, or if that's TV, broadcast, et cetera?
I think increasingly, you know, people who bring others together, whether that's in the room, online, think, how do we make this more inclusive to someone who couldn't afford to get to central Manchester or central Auckland, wherever it happens to be? How do we get a question from someone who felt a bit shy initially, but get their thoughts as well? And all of that requires, like it or not, people to try and weave those strings together. So it's absolutely what I've noticed is a bit of a gap has emerged, because of course in the old days someone would go, oh, we'll get John from marketing to be our MC. And now you throw all of the new gadgets and tools at John or Sue and they freak out a little bit more. So it's absolutely not something I've perfected, but I'm committed to getting really great at it, to give other people a really good experience of getting together. Because the one thing I do think, Tom, is the days of mediocre gatherings are probably gone. Because if you can stay at home, you probably will.
I love that crystallized statement. The days of mediocre gatherings are gone. even in our online, my own experience, which I think would be quite common among the audience, would be that I spent a lot of time on evening events in the first 3 or 4 or 6 months of the pandemic. And then you'd start seeing an invitation to one, and you'd sign up for a register for it, and they were often free or very inexpensive. And then you'd get on it, and the chat would be closed, and it would be a one interviewee or a panel discussion, and there's no interaction with the audience whatsoever. And I'm going, they could have just sent me the recording.
Yes.
All right. So it's the idea of it being an event. And one of the ones that really struck me that people were getting it was a young person I know had a university graduation, and I will call out positively the university that got this right. It's Loughborough University. And in summer 2021, so obviously it did, I'm not sure what they did in summer 2020, I wasn't involved, but summer 2021 they had graduations. And they put it in, and my oldest son had graduated from that same university a number of years before, and they pretty much replicated the experience from their sports hall out to a big grassy area. And first of all, the marquee gave confidence, there was spacing of people, and they lifted the sides because it was a sunny day and air was passing around. That said, the crux of it was that I knew people who were in the audience because tickets were limited, and they had cameras and big screens, et cetera, et cetera. And I was watching the live stream. And we realized when the people I knew got back to London and we all met up and celebrated, et cetera, that they'd had a different feed than we had.
Oh.
And I thought, wow, they're getting the event right. So not only was there a full-blown camera crew on site doing close-ups and different yes. cut shots and really properly produced, but the screens on either side of the stage were projecting things for the audience that were present there.
Yes, got it.
The audience present at home was getting a differently produced yeah. feed. And I was thinking, that would never have happened, you know, in the past. And it does take me to one of my past podcast guests is a friend called Mark Rowland, who couldn't resist, who used to work in the Tony Hsieh's universe in Las Vegas.
All yes, delivery Zappos, R.I.P.
Zappos, culture, all that kind of thing. And then he couldn't resist an opportunity to work in the innovation hub for one of the biggest employers in the U.S., the U.S. Air Force. There's something like 700,000 people.
Yeah.
And they have a 30-story office building in Vegas as an innovation hub. And they just had enormous budget and threw it at things like running hybrid events.
Yes.
And they said it's a full-blown TV production to run a hybrid event.
Yeah, well, I think the you know, the stage is set now, and I think the missing ingredient, and I'm not suggesting I bring much of this, but is imagination, is daring to reimagine. Because what tends to happen, and I've had some calls recently with a company based on the West Coast who create their own virtual worlds, they're called Virbella, and the challenge is people will try and literally translate whatever they've been doing in the real world. So the vice chancellor sees this wonderful virtual world and says, oh, does that mean I could stand up in a virtual auditorium and speak to all of my teams, thousands of them, and give them my special address? Or likewise, the conference organizer says, does that mean we can have a booth and presumably some digital mints? To which the answer is, yeah, you could, but you could also stand on the side of a mountain. Yeah.
Well, yeah, one of the networks I'm involved with, who will have get togethers and stuff online now and globally, et cetera. And one of them, they said, let's try something new that we're trying. And to the point you're kind of making, the imagination also means going to first principles thinking of what are we looking to, how are we looking to connect people, how are we looking to include people. And what this one did, and I'm pretty introverted, so put me in a room full of people with wine glasses and say, go network. Mm-mm. And that's my idea of the seventh circle of hell. Uh-huh. I will hide in the corner or find somebody who knows me, and I'll monopolize their time till they bring us into the into the auditorium. So what this was they thought this was the most brilliant idea possible. You'd walk into an empty space with 50 other people with avatars, and you had to join a group that was talking. And if you got close to it, you could hear them talking, right? Or hear them murmuring. If you got close, you could hear what they were saying. And you had to, like, join this group, leave this group. Mm-hmm. It had everything about a random networking event that people who love those events wanted to replicate. And the people who have their own form of diversity, like of just not liking them, couldn't stand. So yes. It was like, but the crux of it was not so much my bias against it. It was actually trying to just copy what you're doing before.
Yes. Well, it raises very briefly, Tom, it raises a bigger point around if you've got the luxury of redesigning something, rethink who the designers are as your first step. And so absolutely invite to that meeting the colleague that you happen to know hates physical gatherings and mixers and ask them if there's anything that would make it better. You know, is seeing who's going to be there in advance a help or a hindrance or neither? Is having a host to go around, welcome you as you come in and help usher you around the space a help or a hindrance? And by the way, I refer our listener to your interview with Siobhan on this recently, where you are very clear about the sort of connecting you do and don't enjoy. I just think that when we talk to people in power, whether that's a mayor or a politician or a brand, we often talk about their power to convene. And my observation is they are relatively thoughtless about how they design those conventions, if you like, those convening moments. They think it's enough to get people in a physical or virtual space, hand out the refreshments and let them go to it. And I just don't think that's going to cut it now. I think we have to be far more thoughtful, far more, just far more creative, really. But because we've not got time, right? We have urgent problems to solve, and we have to think who's not in the room. How do we get them in the room? How do we make them feel comfortable? How do we tread this very interesting tightrope between exclusivity, hand-picked events, and openness? You know, these are big tangles that we have to start to unpick. We have to do it quickly.
Wow. Yeah. So that was Siobhan Fitzpatrick, who runs a thing called the Networking Hub. A couple of my other guests have been Lynn Pilkington, who is very much about inclusivity and neurodiversity in gathering people. And another one is an inclusivity specialist, is Patricia Costozzo, who was on recently. Mm-hmm. This makes me think I need to get Priya Parker on here, who wrote a book called The Art of Gathering.
Yes. I think she'd be a great guest.
It's absolutely fascinating that we've gone in this direction. So, yeah, it's, you know, in just a tiny note I put ahead of your bio on the page was just about your curiosity. So you ask great questions, but that's fascinating that there's a design role for you in this.
For everybody,
if you will, a convening of the. It's a different form of expertise. It is.
And I think, something I talked to colleagues about, the best events, very briefly, the best events are, I call them Doha, but not the, you know, Emirati city. I mean, they're well designed, they're well organized, they're well hosted, and they're well amplified. And not everybody understands the difference, by the way, between organizing something and hosting it. And my point is, having real people in a room, physical or virtual, joining dots, sparking connections, bringing those people who feel a bit like a wallflower out of their shells, making them feel comfortable, because otherwise it's only the loud ones that get to share anything. We all know it's the quiet ones that have got the real value. And by the way, going into schools with tenor, the single most powerful two things I say to kids, and I've been into dozens and dozens of schools, Tom. One is, I've met a lot of successful people and they're not good at everything. So the most successful people I meet have things they're not good at. And half the kids in the room grow sort of, you know, 4 inches just hearing that thought. But the second observation I make is that the most successful people I've met are not the loudest ones. Again. And by this time, you've got the whole class listening. And it's a little tangent, but I think, you know, if anything, post-pandemic, may we see the rise of the quiet ones.
I can function very well in an extroverted space, and I'm a generally pretty good communicator verbally or in writing. But yeah, the power of introverts is a, I'm trying to think of the author who wrote about this most.
Susan Cain, was it Calm or Quiet?
Susan Cain, yes, is absolutely a leader in this with a fantastic TED talk. And she really leads with some thoughts on this. You're absolutely right. C-A-I-N Cain. I'm also particularly fascinated now with neurodiversity. And, as often happens, it's from a personal space, whether it's me or a family member or somebody else close to me. But yes, going into schools and talking to them about the fact that, you don't have to follow the conventional path. And, you know, I dropped out of university twice and became a theme park entertainer, if you will, trying to translate that for the non-UK audience. Or a host is another way of putting it. Yeah. And hey, by most empirical measures, I've been pretty successful.
Well, joining dots there, Tom, Sarah, a colleague of mine, hosts a podcast called Squiggly Careers. And that plays to this idea that if you speak to any room of adults and you ask them to put their hand up if they're doing today what they thought they'd be doing when they were a teenager, a tiny number of hands go up. I think that's very, very interesting. I also very taken by, if you want to root into it, by the way, the hashtag made by dyslexia. And that will lead you to this abundance of interesting stories and content. And it just strikes me, Tom, that on neurodiversity, when I'm interviewing people about how they get talent into their organization, they have accidentally optimized for people who are good over a coffee. And that worries me massively. And I'm not convinced that enough people in companies can talk intelligently about how they optimize for neurodiverse talent approaching their organization. I just think it's a big, if I can put it that way, a big blind spot.
Yeah, I totally agree. So that could affect people whose communication styles, whose introvert-extrovert scale is on the introvert. Yeah. Another one is the filters that are used for universities and jobs. I wrote something the other day, one of my blogs was about this topic, specifically focused on ADHD. Uh-huh. And I've been studying up on this, and I made a link to a fantastic young man who's writing about this, who is profoundly ADHD. And the two bits that I've learned, one is that the ADHD people are time blind. They operate in two time frames, now and not now. So if I've got somebody I know is ADHD that I want to be in touch with, I'll say, shall we talk at the weekend if they're several time zones apart, right? They go, sure, let's talk on Sunday. Crickets on Sunday. Yeah. Because they say it at the time and they mean it at the time, but it's just not now.
Yeah.
So try to fit someone like that in the education system. It's profoundly difficult.
Yeah.
Now, linked to business, one of the things about there are different, obviously, there are many differences, so I'm generalizing. But many ADHD people, as I understand it, the idea that they're constantly distracted and scattered is very much a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
They're very creative. They're great problem solvers. Right? And when they find something they're interested in, they are interest motivated, not importance motivated.
Mm.
So give them a task list, they're never going to do it. But get them something they're interested in. The average ADHD person will enter a space which we refer to as flow or in the zone 4 to 5 times a day and be highly focused.
Yes.
I mentioned this to somebody who works in science in inclusion, and they went, that's our whole R&D department.
Yes.
They can't stick to schedules, but when they get their head down, they don't lift it up. And without that, you wouldn't have, for example, Fleming going, what's that mold on the jelly tray, and focusing on that and inventing penicillin. Now ask most CEOs how often they get to be totally focused for an endless period of time on anything. Yes. And the answer is once a month or never.
Yes.
And how well would we benefit if we encourage these, you know, you've talked about introversion, I've mentioned ADHD. If we really recognize that those types of diversity that our education system does not support.
Yes.
And, you know, if you want really brilliant people to go into, say, let's just say investment banking, do you know what the prerequisite for investment banking to be really highlighted now is?
Tell me.
A high level maths degree or physics degree.
Hmm.
Because they've established their filter is you need to be able to do that. So everybody who works at those investment banks generally went to a top college and did maths and or physics.
Isn't that interesting? And are you thinking that could be problematic?
Well, I think anything where we end up with groupthink.
Yes.
And we don't recognize the abilities of having or what it means to have a squiggly career, or they also often say now that a career is not a career ladder, it's a jungle gym, you jump around.
Yes, that's
but true. Actually, just, you know, in every corporation, and I work with quite large corporations sometimes, and I work on governance and boards and stuff like this, they always have a risk committee now, certainly since the GFC in 2008. Hmm. And on that risk committee, they think about the risks that they're taking and how to manage their risks, et cetera. But if they all think the same and they've all had the same career path, the biggest risk is there's nobody in the room going, what about this angle?
Well, that's right. And so, Tom, this is why I long to come and see you for a coffee and maybe something else just to continue this conversation, because I think in a world in which we're increasingly recorded as we are now, and minuted and noted, how confident are we still create space to take risks with ideas? Mm-hmm. You know, David Ogilvy said the best ideas come as jokes, so make your thinking as funny as possible. Well, for some people, that means being provocative with your thinking. To others, that means treading a very fine line, actually, between causing upset and offense. So there's some thinking across there. But back in the middle of what you were saying, I think even the broad brushes are fascinating when we talk about, you know, ADHD, dyslexia, for example. Right at the start of the pandemic, I was struggling with an aspect of my health, and someone, again, a coach, said to me, have you done a York test, which is just a personalized food test, a prick of blood, send it off and you get the results. Turned out I was allergic to cow's milk, or certainly highly intolerant, also yeast, also pork, also egg yolk. Making a tiny change to my diet completely changed my health within weeks in a way that I'd been struggling for years. And it just made the very obvious point to me that, yeah, we can read the top tips in our favorite newspaper about being healthy, but ultimately everybody's body is different.
Yes.
And I like that idea about everybody's brain being different.
Hmm.
And when I interviewed Raj Day last week, Rajiv Day from Learnably, a marketplace for learning and development, he says when people join Learnably, they fill out what's essentially a user manual, which says, I'm Tom, and here's everything you might need to know about me in terms of what I love, what I don't love, how I work best. And that becomes almost the operating instruction for everybody to say, if we're going to go into this and be serious, there are a few things you should understand. But I think that idea of personalization is absolutely fascinating. What a great conversation we'd have and say, how does your brain work? And how does that differ to mine? And then we can understand how to get the best out of each other's brains. And we'll look back and suddenly realize we were going along at 18, 20%.
That's a fascinating one. And I'm not going to, you mentioned this company that's doing this. It makes me think of, I'm joining dots here and making sense of this. So I pay for private medical insurance in the UK, mostly because I was used to it my whole life, living in a place where there was no universal healthcare. I love the NHS. I've unfortunately had cause to use them by having a couple of health issues, and they're amazing. But I also thought, for £100 a month, I'm privileged enough to be able to afford that. But it used to be £1,000 or £2,000 in the States, right? So it's like, I'll do that. But I chose a company called Vitality. And what I found interesting about them is they put some of their underwriting costs into health and health benefits and gamifying it and bonuses. I'm thinking they've got 2 million customers in the UK and they're gathering incredible data on the power of prevent exercise and nutrition and diet and cessation of smoking for those who smoke, because they offer benefits around all of that. And if I think about that, if this company you're talking about gathers all this data, and then we get in the conversation, not for today because we're coming towards a close, but, you know, it's like the community wealth in that data, which they can choose to monetize 100%, or they can choose to, and there's privacy concerns if it's not in aggregate, but if in aggregate, there could be a thing where they go, well, let's find a balance between our key asset will become all the data, which is a very common thing in tech startups.
Yes.
But, you know, do we monetize that 100%, or do we actually give that to the education system, or a bit of both?
Yeah. And the crucial filter there, Tom, is or the crucial factor is trust, right? Between the individual and the organization, because the central question then becomes, how well do we really understand each other? So of course, in the future, technology will notice things about our speech, the way we walk, how we sleep, how we type. But there's lots that we can tell it in the meantime to sort of break down those barriers between ourselves, saying, look, we can support each other better if we know better about each other. And I think it's very uplifting thing. I've just hosted a 2-day event in Dubai around prevention of blindness. Did you know if you can't see, then you're looking at a 20% hit on your productivity, but forget your ability to pick tea or operate machinery, you're suffering a confidence hit. So in all forms, these lack of understandings are getting in our way. They're the sort of handbrakes on all of us, which, if nothing else, now we ought to wake up to those.
Well, to move towards wrapping up, because I like to keep these relatively compact and not go too far over 30 minutes. And I will always give my guest pretty much the last word, but I'm looking to pull together some of the thoughts. Your thought at the beginning of the pandemic was, how can I be useful? And you are somebody who connects and brings people together. I also was interested in the piece about that you like starting things. You like, teaming up with interesting people, join a few dots and start things. And for those who are involved in startups and entrepreneurial stuff, it's a really important thing, which we can always talk about another day. And let's meet up in towns in London sometime and solve some more problems of the universe. Is that there's a big distinction between somebody who starts things and somebody who builds things. And I think it's really wonderful to go, actually, I'm a starter, right? And you can be still remain connected and say, how can I help? And you're a shareholder in different businesses, etc. But that's, as somebody who has mentored, I don't coach startups anymore, but as somebody who continues to mentor people in startups and growth companies, that's often one of the most challenging conversations. It's like, the person, the visionary founder, startup energy connector, is very often not the person who's the get in the trenches and spend a couple of years building it person.
Yeah.
But actually having that awareness helps you actually go, well, where is my ikigai? And speaking of that, the person who came up with that 4 Venn diagram circle thing is Mark Wynn.
That's right.
He's the guest on the show in a few weeks.
He is.
And the idea of what am I good at? What do I love?
Yeah.
What does the world need and what can I be paid for? And finding that overlap.
Yeah. So, well, you're kindred island spirits, you and Mark Wynn, aren't you really? And I'm delighted your paths have fully crossed. I mean, I just think it builds into the self-awareness point, maybe. I just knew from a relatively early business phase that I didn't want to do things on my own. So right. I'm always thinking, how might I turn that potential weakness into a strength? And frankly, there is a strength in somebody doing multiple things, because you can cross-pollinate ideas. I had dinner last night with some amazing co-founders. I'm a shareholder in their company. And the compliment they paid me was, you remind us why we got started. We've got into the weeds and you helped us rethink, and that's a compliment, and you're great at that as a sounding board, Tom. I think the great myth that a lot of people suffer with, I think, which says I must become irreplaceable, that's the secret, because then they can never get rid of me. And I think that's really flawed. And I think Charles Saatchi said, if people who are irreplaceable can't be promoted. And I think what that means in entrepreneurship is people who are irreplaceable can't move on. And that's a problem, not just for the organization, but also for the individual, because I think exciting lives contain many, many chapters, certainly many chapters. And so you've got to think, A, how does this thing continue if I go under a bus? But B, if I did get wiped out, how strong would that organization be? And if the answer's just as strong as it was when you're around, well, fine, but it's definitely worth a longer conversation.
Well, and I can't help but jump in on that. And we could do this all day. We'll have to stop at some moment. One of the early business books I read in my 30s, I started to look at, okay, let me really start researching this. Once I built a foundation, was Jack Welch's autobiography when he retired as CEO of what was at that time the biggest company in the world, General Electric, GE. And there were people who developed Six Sigma as a method of effective management. And the piece I took out of his book was, and he was a very confident man, perhaps bordering on less positive traits. But the piece I took out was, the first thing you should do upon being promoted to a new management role is identify your successor.
Yeah.
Because you will need to be moving on to the next thing. And I was quite literally this week mentoring somebody in their mid-30s on their career development. And I said, having coached them towards what they want to do, is just stay in the same organization and develop. I went, great. Okay, so what does that look like? And when would that happen? I said, so you've got a, it turned out they've got a conversation with their boss in a few weeks. I said, okay, I'm ready for your role in a period of years. Right? So let's talk about what do I need to do to develop my team. And let me, and also ask him a bunch, ask your boss a bunch of questions about what's different in their role to what they see you do. Yeah. And what might they be doing next?
And great question.
Never thought about it in that way. It's just, well, look at the level of what's next for you. And therefore, where are you now? What do they see in their own role and your role? And just have the open conversation, remove the fear. Have the trust and have the confidence. Anyway, sorry, we could talk for ages.
To be continued.
To be continued. And I'll talk to my people as we bullshit away. But you do have a team Barrett, whereas I have the amazing Katie, and everybody should have a VA, if not more. Because the ADHD, I'm on the ADHD spectrum at some level, for sure, we all are. And part of me is, I the one thing I do not enjoy doing is managing my diary. So I have somebody do that for me, no matter how quiet it is. Let me shut up and hand over to you, Ollie. What are your thoughts from the conversation today, and what would you like to leave with people?
I'm just calling myself out really on all these things, because I can get to stage two, which is looking back at conversations I've been having on ADHD or dyslexia, neurodiversity, designing events. Mm-hmm. But then quite quickly, I call myself out going, are you really living that? Do you actually understand in depth? Are you triggering and making those conversations happen? Are you absolutely convinced that the next two events you're lined up to host, the guests will have a good navigating experience through the event? So my final thought is just call myself out. You know, I wrote a course in lockdown on building better networks, and the reason I wrote it was to call myself out, because it's all very well writing a chapter on how to send a long shot email, but I end up asking myself, have you sent one of those today? You know, write a chapter on keeping in touch. How good are you at keeping in touch? Yeah. So forgive the self-indulgent reflection, but, for anyone tuned into this, please note to self, received loud and clear. And, what we've opened is a series of important topics, but that's just chat until we put it into deeds.
Well, I will finish off on something, which is when I had Patricia Gastoso on this, she asked me, she talked about making your website inclusive, and I literally went to her afterwards and had her consult on my website and made some subtle changes on that. So I called myself out, and I talk about open leadership, that there are two sets of two traits that the leaders we need for today and tomorrow have. First of all, to be brave and hungry, right? To have that ambition. Mm. However, those in isolation could be the sort of toxic old school command and control.
Yeah.
So the other two, which goes so much with it, are being open and humble. And thank you for modeling that in your clothes.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me. And you've got me thinking about accessibility in my site. The subtitles campaign has inspired me to put subtitles on the things I put out from now on. But I know we must close. But Tom, thanks to you for all you do, and keep at it. Thanks so much for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in IRL soon.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, Ollie.